you would prefer the human race to endure, right? You're hesitating.
Yeah, well, I...
Yes?
I don't know. I would...
This is Peter Thiel.
This is a long hesitation. This is a long hesitation.
There's so many questions in place.
Should the human race survive?
Yes.
Okay.
But
he's been a major player in Silicon Valley for a long, long time.
I'm Peter Thiel. I build companies and I support people who are building new things, from social networks to rocket ships.
You might know him as the multi-billionaire who co-founded PayPal and Palantir, as Facebook's first outside investor, the guy who funds out there projects like floating countries, private space travel, and the quest for immortality. Peter Thiel rejects the idea that death is inevitable. He wants to transform humanity.
Transhumanism was this radical transformation where your human natural body gets transformed into an immortal body. We want you to be able to change your heart and change your mind and change your whole body.
But he also wants to change something else. For decades, Thiel has schemed from the shadows to reshape American politics.
Tonight, I urge all of my fellow Americans to stand up and vote for Donald Trump.
He bankrolled Trump's first campaign. He turbocharged J.D. Vance's career. Thiel openly questions the democratic system, and he's declared that to him, freedom is incompatible with democracy. His vision of an ideal society sounds more like an oligarchy, a country ruled by a few powerful rich people, or even just one. Today, his influence is rapidly expanding across the world. From the beginning of his career, he's been building tools to rewire how power works. Palantir, his brainchild, enables intelligence agencies and militaries to anticipate their enemy's next move before it's made. Maybe even your next move, too. None of this happened by accident. Peter Thiel plays the long game. He's patiently planned his moves for decades, always several steps ahead. So what does Peter Thiel actually want? What's his problem with democracy? And is there an end game? This video is largely based on the research collected in The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power by Max Chefkin. You'll find a link in the description. New York City, 2010. A TV show has set up a night for Peter Thiel to meet Garry Kasparov, one of the greatest chess players of all time. Thiel and Kasparov have met before and get along well. They like chatting about politics, technology, and of course, chess. Peter Thiel's a diehard chess fan. In fact, he's a national chess master. He's admired the Grandmaster Kasparov since he was a teenager. And the respect is mutual. Kasparov admires Thiel's intelligence and business sense.
He's one of the probably most successful entrepreneurs of his generation. He's very aggressively investing. He looks for the future.
Thiel's legendary status in business is hard to overstate. His companies have created technologies that have changed the course of the modern world. And his influence helped define tech, an industry that has produced millions of jobs and trillions of dollars of wealth. That night, Kasparov and Thiel hit up a chess club. Thiel plays a game of speed chess with the owner and wins.
I'm totally embarrassed.
I'm embarrassed as well.
Kasparov suggests his chess skills are probably why Thiel's such a successful businessman, and why he tends to hire chess players for his companies.
You know, that's why he's hiring chess players, you know? Peter just told me the story that one day had the IPO for PayPal. So he did a simul for 10 employees of PayPal.
And sure, Thiel is probably onto something. Chess skills transfer well into the world of business. It's a game of strategy, where it pays off to think several moves ahead. Skills that don't hurt in politics either. Sometime after this evening, Kasparov and Thiel drift apart. Maybe the two don't have that much in common after all. It's not just that the Russian Kasparov is a way better chess player. He's also one of the world's most prominent pro-democracy activists. He's a major thorn in Putin's side, tirelessly campaigning for a freer Russia.
So I'm fighting to restore democracy in my country.
Trump's potential victory could threaten not only democracy in this country, but, democracy worldwide.
And Peter Thiel? Well, kind of the opposite trajectory. Critics warn he's emerging as a major threat to American democracy. Billionaires like Thiel reshaping politics is terrifying. Connecting to airport Wi-Fi ranks way lower on the scale. But having your data floating around unprotected online is a threat you can actually do something about. This is where today's sponsor NordVPN comes in. NordVPN encrypts your internet traffic so your personal data stays private. With the shopping season in full swing, think twice before clicking that deal that looks too good to be true. It can happen to anyone. Regular VPNs don't always protect you against fake web stores. NordVPN's Threat Protection Pro helps you avoid malware, hackers, and trackers even when you're not connected to a VPN. It's a certified anti-phishing tool recognized by leading cybersecurity labs. Try NordVPN risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee and go to nordvpn.com/ferntv for a huge discount plus 4 extra months. You can also scan this QR code or check the link in the description. Wait, did you actually just scan that QR code? Peter Thiel is around 8 years old when his family arrives in Swakopmund, a former German colony on Namibia's coast. He moved here with his parents and brother after some years in Ohio. During the 1970s, the city is occupied by apartheid South Africa. At the time, it's a town clinging to its German roots, where Hitler's birthday is still celebrated and the Nazi salute is a casual greeting for some. Peter's father, Klaus, takes an engineering job at a uranium mine just outside town. The mine is controversial and shrouded in secrecy. According to international law, South Africa isn't allowed to mine here, but they go ahead anyway. Extracting Namibia's uranium is part of South Africa's nuclear weapons program. The regime is secretly developing bombs to defend against a possible Soviet attack and to protect the apartheid way of life. According to a former British activist group, black laborers have worked at the mine under dangerous conditions. Meanwhile, white families like the Thiels enjoy a privileged life. Brand new medical facilities, country club memberships, kids in private school. Young Peter is reportedly first put in a whites-only school in Johannesburg, then in a German language school in Swakopmund, where the curriculum pushes a Christian nationalist worldview and even paints white South Africans as the real victims of the region. This is where Peter Thiel spends formative years. It's a world where his family benefits from a white supremacist regime, where his father actively advances its military interests. A world where the founding belief is that some people are meant to rule, and the majority must serve. When Peter's 10, he and his family return to the US. Peter's developing into a classic nerd. He loves sci-fi and fantasy, especially Lord of the Rings. He's top of the class and becomes one of the country's top chess players under the age of 13. It's not cool to be a nerd in the 70s and 80s, so Peter is reportedly bullied on the regular. But he knows he's smart and going places. His chessboard has a sticker that says Born to Win. Peter wants the best for himself, so he studies hard to get into the top university. At the time, Stanford is ranked number one in the US. When he makes it there in 1985, Stanford's a huge letdown. Peter expects fellow overachievers, but finds a party scene instead. He'd rather hit the books than the bong, and he's once again teased for being a nerd. According to the author Max Chefkin, many of the students he perceived as bullies also identify as liberals, a connection that reportedly sticks with him. We in fact asked Thiel ourselves, but didn't get a response. Peter developed into a Reagan-supporting conservative. The campus itself feels far too left-wing for him. Anti-Reagan and anti-apartheid protests are prominent, and Peter starts to clash with demonstrators. In The Contrarian, Chefkin describes how classmates recall at least one instance where Peter defended apartheid as economically sound, an allegation that Thiel has since denied. At the time, some defenders of apartheid drew on libertarian arguments. Libertarians believe the best society maximizes personal and economic freedom while minimizing government control. They see free, unregulated markets as the best way to allocate resources and drive innovation. More radical libertarians value property rights and free markets above basically anything else. Critics say this leaves little room for values like social justice, which are cast as secondary or even incompatible with a libertarian definition of freedom. From that perspective, apartheid could be rationalized. South Africa's systematic denial of civil rights was simply the price to pay for its higher level of wealth than neighboring countries. By Peter's sophomore year, he's known on campus as a hardcore libertarian. And though the 80s see students increasingly advocate for race and gender equality, Stanford is not an entirely liberal institution. It has a fair share of other conservative and libertarian students and faculty members during Peter's time there. Still, Chefkin describes Peter feeling like he's in the minority, and that the dominant campus culture is hostile to people like him. So he does what he'll keep doing throughout his life. He builds a network of like-minded men, the beginnings of a network that will support him throughout his career, what will later be known as the so-called PayPal Mafia. With 11 other conservative men, Peter launches a campus newspaper. The Stanford Review aims to stir things up. It regularly criticizes campus culture from a conservative perspective, with a famously biting style. Throughout Peter's time at Stanford, a few pieces especially stir the pot. Chefkin found a few examples in the Stanford archives that he wasn't allowed to reproduce. One columnist claimed that gay men engage in unnatural sex. Another complained when Stanford considered adding non-white authors to the Western Culture course, arguing it signaled the decline of the West. One whole issue was devoted to passionately defending a student accused of statutory rape, who was later found guilty. Peter's not just looking to provoke. He wants money, power, and influence. And as its founding editor-in-chief, the Stanford Review launches him into the public intellectual he's known as today. The paper captures the attention of high-profile conservatives, and a bit later, Peter gets a book deal. The Diversity Myth is co-authored with David Sacks, the student who wrote in defense of an accused rapist in the Stanford Review. Nowadays, Sacks is also an influential figure on the American right. He currently serves the Trump administration as the White House's AI and crypto czar. The book argues that universities are dangerous breeding grounds for left-wing intellectual conformity, that nowadays, real racism barely exists in America, and that diversity initiatives pose a threat to Western culture. Sacks and Thiel have since apologized for some of the more controversial parts of the book, but these are the same anti-woke sentiments that are winning elections today.
You know, I ended woke, totally.
Everything woke turns to shit. Our country will be woke no longer.
Though Peter has plenty of gripes about Stanford, he stays on and graduates from its law school in 1992. He moves to New York to begin his legal career. Only aiming for the best, his goal is to clerk for the Supreme Court. He's got top grades, his own influential paper, and connections to the right people. But it's not enough.
I got interviews with two justices. They normally interview eight people and select four as clerks, and I missed it with both, and it felt like it was the absolute end of the world.
Peter's not used to setbacks. He plunges into what he later described as a quarter-life crisis and briefly moves back in with his parents. But back on the West Coast, Peter proves he has a knack for turning losses into big wins. It's 1996. The tech industry is booming. Silicon Valley is a place with endless possibilities, loads of investor money, and above all, unclear rules. Peter wants in. Sure, he can't really code, but he can hand that off on someone else. Peter studies up on hedge fund management, raises some capital, and reinvents himself as an investor. At the same time, he continues publishing anti-woke columns. One that claims Indigenous Peoples Day is anti-Western winds up in the Wall Street Journal. By chance, Peter meets the brilliant young cryptographer Max Levchin. Max is obsessed with Palm Pilots, clunky little handheld computers. At the time, they're barely more than a calendar with an internet connection. Not all investors would listen to a 20-something jabber away about Palm Pilots. But Peter's not a typical investor. Max believes Palm Pilots will have way more potential if they can be linked to businesses. If personal devices were linked to a business's infrastructure, a whole new world of uses would open up. Like connecting an individual directly with a bank. All someone needs to figure out is how to build an encrypted network that can securely link a handheld device with a corporate system. And Max believes he can do it. He is way ahead of his time, and Peter sees the potential immediately. He offers Max $250,000 investment the very next day. Peter will become known for these big bets on inexperienced founders. Bets that very often pay off. On the surface, PayPal looks just like another convenient way to pay. But in reality, it was built on a radically libertarian vision. Money moving freely, beyond government control. The same vision that would later drive the crypto movement. And just like crypto, that freedom quickly attracts the gray areas of the economy. PayPal's early growth comes from industries most banks avoided, like gambling and NSFW stuff. Good thing Peter's been nurturing his political connections. As Chefkin tells it, Thiel worked to keep his business alive by lobbying Congress to keep online gambling legal and to stop PayPal from being treated as a national bank. We also asked Peter Thiel directly about this, but didn't get a response either. E-commerce is exploding in popularity. There's high demand for a tool that can simplify online transaction. And Max and Peter aren't the only ones working on a solution. PayPal isn't even the only online payment startup in the same building. There's a very similar company on the same floor. It's called X.com, and its founder has a lot in common with Peter. Most notably, Elon Musk is also an enterprising immigrant with roots in South Africa. Like Peter, he also shows little regard for traditional rules of the banking industry. Playing by every rule only slows down growth. But for a while, they have no idea what each other's companies are for. Until a PayPal employee finds a business plan for X.com in a dumpster. And then it becomes impossible to ignore each other. They become two of the biggest fish in the sea of online payments. PayPal's growing rapidly, but at the same time bleeding funds. Every new user gets a cash bonus, most transactions rack up fees, and servers are expensive. Worse, the anonymity that makes PayPal attractive also opens the door to credit card fraud, and PayPal would have to refund the victim's stolen money. Max left in response by building an anti-fraud system called Igor, software that flags suspicious patterns and blocks scam transactions. All the while, user anonymity is still preserved. Igor successfully curbs fraud by half of what it was. The FBI takes interest in the technology and starts using the software to catch money launderers. Still, PayPal isn't profitable. Peter thinks he knows the answer. It has to become a monopoly. Eliminate competitors, dominate the market, and set the rules. As Peter often puts it,
competition is for losers.
Competition is for losers. Competition is for losers.
This strategy will come to define Peter Thiel's success. He'll outline it in the business best-selling book 0 to 1, and it will become a guiding principle in the tech industry.
What I think everybody who is a founder or entrepreneur should aim to do is build a monopoly. And all the great companies that people have built are monopolies of one sort or another.
By 2000, the online payment space has grown more competitive, and PayPal is still operating at a loss. Elon suggests a merger, and Peter agrees. Uniting is their best chance for survival. According to The Contrarian, they clash from the start. Over the name, over the software. Elon becomes CEO because he's a bigger shareholder, but Peter allegedly can't stand his leadership. He's said to think Elon's a reckless egomaniac, and Elon is said to think Peter's a sociopath who only cares about money. Their battles stall the company's growth, so Thiel decides to end them. Elon goes on his honeymoon, leaving the CEO position undefended. And in an elegant, calculated move, Peter captures it. Lefkin and others loyal to Thiel start voicing their gripes about Musk. They manage to convince enough board members to oust Musk and to insert Thiel as temporary CEO, a position he'll keep. It won't be Thiel's last tactical takedown. As CEO of PayPal, Peter Thiel is on a whole new playing field. In 2002, he secures a landmark deal. eBay acquires PayPal for $1.5 billion. Thiel becomes a multimillionaire at 35 years old, walking away with at least $55 million from the deal. Now he has the capital and credibility to pursue his wildest dreams. The day he signs the deal is the day he also steps down as CEO. PayPal was just a stepping stone. Now he's ready to move on to bigger and bolder projects. And to live the high life as a very rich person. He buys a silver Ferrari and fancy apartments. Now the formerly bullied kid is the life of the party. More and more people want to be in his orbit. Thiel's personal trajectory is skyrocketing. But the country is spiraling. In the wake of 9/11, Americans also face a recession, an unpopular war, and widespread trauma. Thiel is anxious too. He's increasingly concerned with the threat of religious terrorism. He finds the Bush administration isn't tough enough on Islam. His politics seem to shift. At Stanford, he wrote fiery libertarian essays railing against government power. Now he's arguing the opposite, that the US must use extrajudicial methods to catch terrorists. As he put it, outside the checks and balances of representative democracy as described in high school textbooks. For Thiel, the trade-off is clear. The West must compromise. More security, less freedom. And he sees a business opportunity in it. What if Igor, the software Max Levchin built to catch fraudsters, could be retooled to catch terrorists? Wouldn't the CIA be interested? In 2003, Thiel gets a team to start working on it right away. They'll call the company Palantir. In The Lord of the Rings, a Palantir is a mythical stone that sees and communicates across far distances. Sauron, the evil character who seeks to dominate Middle-earth, uses a Palantir to spy on enemies and conspire with allies.
The power of Isengard is at your command, Sauron, Lord of the Earth.
Basically, Thiel is offering Sauron's power to anyone who can afford it. Palantir's promise? Use network analysis to find unforeseen patterns in vast troughs of data. This is especially interesting to US intelligence agencies who had collected information on Al-Qaeda conspirators but failed to see the connections till after the attack. In the early years, many users are disappointed with Palantir's service, but their timing is excellent with everyone terrified of another attack. And Thiel's chosen CEO is excellent at raising money. His name is Alex Karp. He's another former Stanford classmate. When Osama bin Laden is captured and killed, rumors circulate that Palantir was used to find him. Public interest in the company skyrockets. Based on what's known today about Palantir's abilities at the time, any meaningful involvement is questionable. When media outlets ask Alex Karp about that rumor, he's careful not to confirm or deny involvement. He tends to dodge the question with a smile and imply that some connection is there.
Did your company help to track and kill Osama bin Laden?
When you open the paper and look in the news about these kind of things, there's a two-thirds chance, depending on the country involved, that somehow my company was involved.
One media outlet isn't buying the hype. A gossipy blog called Gawker. According to Max Chefkin, Gawker's Silicon Valley page reports no real link between Palantir and the bin Laden raid, and suggests the company spread the rumor just to boost sales. ValleyWeg is known for roasting the tech industry back when most news outlets tend to sing its praises. And a favorite target of Gawker's gossip and mockery is Peter Thiel. Thiel will take care of Gawker later. Beyond founding Palantir, Thiel spends the 2000s turning tech startups into giants.
I was the sort of first angel investor in Facebook in summer of 2004. The business was already tracking quite well. They only needed money to buy more computers, so I think that was always sort of a promising sign.
In 2004, he becomes Facebook's first big investor. Thiel not only funds the company, but becomes Zuckerberg's mentor. Now Zuckerberg is one of the richest people alive, and Thiel's investment will net him about $400 million. Thiel doesn't stop there. Through his network, he backs Airbnb, Spotify, SpaceX, and later OpenAI. In 2007, Thiel seems to have spotted the financial crisis early. He bets against the US housing market. The gamble pays off. A 60% return in just 6 months. Banks will collapse, and around 9 million Americans will lose their jobs. But for Thiel, it's cause for celebration. According to Chefkin, he flies his stuff to Maui, with unlimited tabs for food, booze, massages, and surfing. We asked Peter Thiel if this is true, but he didn't answer. But Thiel's golden run doesn't last. After a string of bad investments and mass redemptions, his hedge fund suffers huge losses and all but collapses. By 2011, he will have lost nearly two-thirds of his clients' money. The crisis seems to make Thiel more cynical. In 2009, he writes that he still believes in libertarian principles, but no longer in democracy. "I no longer believe that freedom and democracy are compatible," he declares. He argues that America has been in decline since the 1920s, when women gained the right to vote and when the Great Depression created mass unemployment. In his view, women and poor people are especially hostile to libertarian policies. Their ability to vote stands in the way of his ideal society. The essay makes waves. Gawker Media calls him a loopy libertarian, ridiculing him for wishing women couldn't vote. Thiel later clarifies it's not that he wants to take one class of voters' rights away. the problem is that Americans in general won't vote for libertarian policies. So, better to do away with democracy altogether? Meanwhile, Gawker Media gleefully reports Thiel's investment failures. They claim he exaggerates his net worth and make fun of his hypocrisies. Gawker reported on a lot of important topics other media outlets wouldn't touch till much later, like the crimes of Harvey Weinstein and Jeffrey Epstein. But they also posted a lot of arguably cruel gossip. In 2007, they outed Thiel's sexual orientation with a post titled, "Peter Thiel is Totally Gay People." Peter Thiel's sexuality was an open secret at the time, but he didn't seem to want it reported. His outing was clearly a violation of privacy. According to The Contrarian, Thiel sees Gawker's coverage as damaging to his business. And plenty of other people have grudges against the site, so Thiel quietly funds a team of lawyers to take up their cases. The decisive moment comes in 2012, when Gawker publishes a leaked sex tape of the wrestler Hulk Hogan. Hogan sues, and Thiel secretly bankrolls the fight with $10 million.
The stage is set for a major courtroom battle. Hulk Hogan, former professional wrestler turned reality star, is taking on media website Gawker.
Gawker is hit with just over $140 million in damages and files for bankruptcy in 2016. Gawker Media is no more. And Thiel is proud of his win, calling it the most philanthropic thing he's ever done. In an interview, he compares the journalists behind the company to terrorists. The world learned that it's dangerous to mess with Peter Thiel. Reporters Without Borders called his feat a serious threat on freedom of the press. Critics argue that this set a precedent for wealthy individuals to weaponize the courts and bury media that criticizes them. But Peter Thiel is just getting started. It's often said that two things in life are certain, death and taxes. Well, Peter Thiel disagrees. What others see as inevitabilities, Thiel sees as problems to be solved. He famously funds biotech companies pursuing life extension. His hatred of taxes has him pour resources into anti-tax political actions and also seasteading, man-made island nations free from income tax and governmental regulations. A floating libertarian utopia where he can escape systems he finds oppressive, an idea he has since abandoned. He looks into other exit plans, like a bunker in New Zealand, which he also later drops, and the chance for humanity to reach Mars. This becomes Peter Thiel's pattern, seeking escape. Escape from rules that govern everyone else. But escape on Peter Thiel's scale doesn't come easily. Immortality research and space exploration require massive resources. Changing tax laws requires massive influence. Fortunately for Thiel, his wealth and influence have grown enormously, so he can attempt to reshape politics to enable his search for escape. In 2007, he does something unusual for Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. He starts funding presidential candidates. His first big bet is the libertarian Ron Paul, a longshot candidate for presidency, but a politician with a passionate base. Like Thiel, Paul is an advocate for extreme free market capitalism. They're also both skeptical of climate change to different degrees. Ron Paul doesn't win the 2008 presidency. Obama does. In 2012, Ron Paul runs again, and this time Thiel is his biggest donor by a long shot. Thiel wasn't really banking on Paul's win. Instead, he was thinking ahead. In an interview with the magazine Slate from 2012, Thiel says he was really campaigning for 2016, building up a strong libertarian base. Thiel seems to want a candidate who will ensure his wealth will be protected, one who will grant more power to the tech industry, and one who shares his view that America is in decline and needs a strong man to become great again. When Trump is revealed as the best candidate to promote those aims, Thiel donates $1.25 million to his campaign. In 2016, Thiel takes the stage at the Republican National Convention during primetime.
Tonight, I urge all of my fellow Americans to stand up and vote for Donald Trump.
Thiel campaigns for Trump as if his views represented Silicon Valley. But at the time, Trump is deeply unpopular in tech. Of the top tech companies in the Valley, not a single CEO donates to Trump's 2016 campaign, and Thiel's support of Trump makes him somewhat of a pariah. According to The Contrarian, friends cut ties with him or refuse to discuss politics. Thiel is unbothered. They'll change their tune soon enough. Besides, he's starting to lean into his image as the Silicon Valley supervillain. He reportedly once said, "I'd rather be seen as evil than incompetent." When Trump shocks the world by winning, Thiel is part of the transition team. His role is to appoint people who will disrupt regulatory bodies like the Federal Trade Commission and the Food and Drug Administration. A dream job for Thiel, who's railed against governmental regulation for decades. Thiel reportedly suggests 150 names to Trump. According to Max Chefkin, his list includes, to no surprise, ultra-libertarians, but also very controversial figures. Fringe people from his growing network of far-right reactionaries. Trump only approves a handful of them, the least controversial suggestions that Thiel makes. So Thiel's first attempt at capturing the White House seems to have failed. Politically, Thiel retreats to the background for a bit. He and his partner have their first child and he seems to focus on family life for a while. But the background is where Peter Thiel thrives the most. Outside of politics, Thiel's businesses are skyrocketing, especially Palantir. During COVID, Palantir wins government contracts to analyze pandemic data, tracking infections and vaccines. In 2025, Business Insider reports that under the second Trump administration, ICE will use Palantir to track down immigrants who overstayed their visas. Palantir's involvement has only intensified under Trump and has been instrumental for over a decade since Obama's second administration. The Guardian reports in 2025 that Palantir provides ICE with tools that help their agents fulfill Trump's aggressive deportation quotas using a vast data network. It includes government records such as tax data from the IRS and private databases like location history from cell phone records. Now Palantir also incorporates facial recognition data from Clearview AI, another startup where Peter Thiel is the first investor. The pattern is clear. Palantir thrives in chaos. And chaos is only ramping up. What looks like a political setback with Trump may just be Thiel's chance to plan his next move. Thiel won't back Trump's second campaign, but he will build up another politician.
We're effectively run in this country via the Democrats, via our corporate oligarchs, by a bunch of childless cat ladies who are miserable at their own lives and the choices that they've made.
Thiel injects J.D. Vance's primary campaign with $15 million. Vance is now Vice President of the United States. Thiel and Vance's relationship didn't come out of nowhere. Vance worked at one of Thiel's companies and Thiel became his mentor, as Vance himself says. And it was also Thiel who brought J.D. Vance and Donald Trump together. After Trump is elected as president again in 2024, several members of the tech elite rally behind him. There's Elon Musk, who is against Trump in 2016 and becomes his most visible supporter in 2024. There's Mark Zuckerberg, who abolishes fact-checkers at Meta less than 2 weeks before Trump takes office. And there's Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google, who donates $1 million to Trump just before inauguration. At the inauguration of Trump's second presidency in January 2025, major tech CEOs are clearly visible in the front row. But one person isn't there that day. He's in the background again. Peter Thiel. Instead, he watches Palantir's stock skyrocket and topping the market for much of 2025. The surge is in part fueled by government contracts. And not just in the US. Palantir has been hired by Israeli forces allegedly to enable AI-powered targeting of Palestinians, which the company denies, and by Ukraine in its war against Russia. These and other contracts not only boost Palantir's profits, they also give the company access to extremely sensitive data. Few assets carry more power or more potential for harm. So who decides how it's used? We reached out to Peter Thiel as well as Palantir because we had a lot of questions. Unfortunately, none of them were answered. In 2012, Peter Thiel said, "One of the things I like about technology is that when technology is unregulated, you can change the world without getting approval from other people. At its best, it's not subject to democratic control and not subject to the majority, which I think is often hostile to change." A recent venture Thiel backed is called Erebor, a crypto bank named after the mountain in The Hobbit where a murderous dragon hoards treasure. And now Trump is pushing one of Thiel's wilder ideas, low-tax freedom cities where corporations can operate without federal regulations.
We'll actually build new cities in our country again. These freedom cities will reopen the frontier, reignite American imagination.
Freedom cities aren't just for making a lot of money. The goal is also to conduct research without governmental approval. One such place already exists, Prospera in Honduras. You already know who helped fund it. The libertarian utopia Peter Thiel dreams of no longer needs Mars or the open ocean. It's being built right in America.